So, what of this famous arbitrariness? The arbitrariness of the sign, I am sorry to put it so blunt, has always been linked to the moral ideology of language. It was not a new concept, not in your time, neither in the theories of Whitney. In fact, the arbitrariness of the sign, too, just as mimesis, dates back in the composition of theories on the origin of language, and, in spite of the fact that these theories seem to have been abandoned, we will have to take them into consideration as their moralistic implication dominate all of linguistics today. It is at least remarkable that philosophers in the past have preoccupied themselves so much with the origin of language, or rather the question how people gained language. Though intriguing in itself, some other questions never arose. For instance, except as part of a grand evolutionary scheme, questions about the origin of hands or feet have never been asked. Why would they be asked, as hands and feet are so obviously part of our bodies? However, the answer may not be so obvious as such. It seems that hands and feet, or feet, is one of those features we share with animal, as is our entire apparatus called body. To ask after the origin would be to ask after the existence of the human race, which is a matter of fact, whether or not created by gods. A similar status has been given to the upright posture and the application of tools, as that too marks the difference between man and animal. I know this all seems a bit far-fetched, but if we look at the human fixation with language, it becomes clear that human beings do not like the idea of an existence ipso facto. The growth of linguistics provides a need for differentiation, primarily between men and animals. This has always been the case, especially where the theories of the origin of language are concerned, and in this question itself lies an entire range of linguistic classifications where signs, signifier, and signification is concerned. Origins of language never superseded two basic ideas, the first being a differentiation from the world of animals, like, for instance, in the work of Condillac and Rousseau, the second being a differentiation from the world of the gods, like, for instance, the work of Zuchsmilk. In the first type, human beings are superior to animals, of course. In the second type, human beings are subordinates of gods, of course. This keystone opposition reveals a characteristic of human language, which is that it needs accessible spheres of life, whether it's God or animals, which are not directly involved in the language process. In fact, the spheres of gods and animals are just as inaccessible for the penetration of human language as are stones. Animals, because they can never talk back to human beings, and gods, because they can provide insights, but need begging or praying or speaking to, and even then communicate unequal understandings. Both types of theories create a model of hierarchy, and it really does not matter whether one or the other is absent, as long as there is one above and one below. There is the embryo of growth necessary for the flow of ideas in terms of enlightened succession. Through imposing a hierarchy on the origin of language, human beings create an embryo as well as a conclusion of time. As it is not very interesting to stand above or below a mere pebble stone, animals and gods will share this hierarchical faith of human nature. It is not surprising then that individual bodies take such a strange subordinate place within the study of language. However, I view time in this sense a little bit different from your linguistic definition of it, which is... But the thing which keeps language from being a simple convention that can be modified at the whim of the interested parties is not its social nature. It is rather the action of the time combined with the social force if time is left out, the linguistic facts are incomplete, and no conclusion is possible. Time here indeed does not stand by itself, but the reason for time lies exclusively in the community of speakers and the social forces which are combined with this action. I truly wonder if anything different could be concluded if one exchanges this idea of action by the social community with that of gods or evolution. Its conclusion would be exactly the same, and time here, I'm sorry, truly signifies a mystical factor that could formally be described as an evolution or supernatural. As you continue to say, if we considered language in time without community, imagine an isolated individual living for several centuries, we probably would not notice change. Time would not influence language. Conversely, if we considered a community of speakers without considering time, we would not see the effects of the social forces that influence language. And then, oh my God, you conclude, language is no longer free, for time will allow the social forces at work on it to carry out their effects. This brings us back to the principles of continuity, which cancels freedom. Well, now there's a splendid definition of freedom. The irony of this definition strikes me as a tautology in which time allows for change, as the same could be said for breathing, which allows for life. The oddity of such examples touches indeed the sheer necessity of an imagination that poses a representation of life, and the example of that isolated individual seems to be returning and reoccurring in theory, as if it were a possible option. There is no such thing as an isolated individual. In fact, what is meant with examples like these always concern individuals who do not experience anything. The only individuals that abide by such a definition are those who are dead. Indeed, it's very unlikely that we will not notice changes in their languages, unless they speak to us from beyond the grave, of course, or keep silence altogether, not unlike animals or gods. We have just as much opportunity to access the isolated individual as we have any other phenomena for which we have but mute communication. In fact, it brings us back where we started with, which is the origin of language.